Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1325. Interview with Matt Crumpton, Jindy Jamiel, and Paul Blow about the Oswald impersonators. This is being recorded on May 24th of the year 2024. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to the audience Jindy Jamiel and Paul Blow, both of them well known from previous programs, and to introduce Matt Crumpton, who is not only a lawyer, and I will we will draw on his legal expertise in terms of presenting and defining the concept of chokeholds, but Matt has also written a superb essay on the Oswald impersonators, and that can be found in the book Chokeholds, about which we have spoken with Jim and Paul in the past. And Paul, you had a note that you wanted to introduce to the audience about the book.
Well, yeah, thank you, first of all, Dave, for having us on your show. It was an absolutely great discussion I feel we had the first time. And I really like being here with Matt and Jim, and you're absolutely right. Matt did a bang-up job on one of the chokeholds called, that describes how this supposed lone nut was impersonated so many times that how could he really be a drifter who came in to be at the right place at the right time to pull off the perfect shot? But we'll get into that later. Before, I just wanted to say that the book is doing incredibly well. We're getting really good reviews, very nice personal comments. There's an essayist called Ed Curtin who wrote up a brilliant review for the book. And, he called it a historical monument encountering this whole lone nut assassination fairy tale in so many words. I would like to maybe ask something of your audience. We have been subject to what my son calls review bombs. So what's a review bomb? It's mostly because we sell an awful lot of books through Amazon. We have about 96 ratings. Again, they're almost all 5 stars or 4-star ratings and great comments. But every now and then you get something that sticks out like a sore thumb, and you can tell when you read it that, it's not truthful or anything, or it's not based on any point of fact. So, and we're getting a little more lately, and the way the authors read this is there's somebody out there who doesn't want this book to be read. So, you're saying, and by the way, this goes back to Operation Mockingbird. Operation Mockingbird, we discuss in the book. Operation Mockingbird was a way of rallying the press to follow suit on what the game plan was by the intelligence or CIA. And it was brought out during the period of the Church Committee and so on and so forth. But in Operation Mockingbird, there's a tactic that involves getting fake book critics. Okay, so they were doing it back then, is to get fake critics of really good books of some of the independent authors. So I think what we're seeing is today's version, but digital, so you're getting, you get a few review bombs like that. So if people in your audience have read Chokeholds and enjoyed it, just saying a nice thing on Amazon can help counter some of this stuff, because I have a feeling they're going to ramp it up. Because again, I really think we do, the authors think Chokeholds is the one book from this year that, not the one book, but one of the books they don't want you to read. So thank you. That's what I wanted to say, Dave.
And the people who haven't read it, why don't you buy it and then drop a review after you buy it? Okay.
Good point.
And I should emphasize that I get no, nor do any of the stations get any money from this. So, with that, I would add that, Paul, Matt, and Jim, The late Norman Mailer opined that in the age of intelligence, meaning espionage, not intellect, every truth is obliged to live in the presence of its denial. And I think that really applies to what we are talking about. Matt, again, as the author of this brilliant essay, you are also a lawyer. Why don't you pinpoint or tie down how the Oswald impersonators constitute a chokehold?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here with all of you guys talking about this. I know I'm amongst the pros, which is very exciting. I mean, you know, from a legal standpoint, there are three basic standards of evidence. There's the, simple, you know, burden of proof. There's the, preponderance of the evidence. That's like in a civil trial, 51%. There's clear and convincing evidence, which is like, you know, more than preponderance, that's 75%. And then there's beyond the shadow of a doubt, of a reasonable doubt. And that is, you know, 99%. So that's an incredibly high standard. We determined that there's not, it's going to be hard to get 99% on anything because, as you all know, what happens when you talk about any issue with this case, with someone who feels strongly that the Warren report is correct, is they pivot to other issues if they don't want to go down the deep dive with you on the particular one that you're on. And they go, well, that's why this must just be a coincidence, right? So, it's going to be really hard to ever get 99, but we thought there are some where you can get that 75%. There are some that have that clear and convincing evidence where, you know, if someone's not dug in, if you're just a reasonable, objective person hearing all the information for the first time, that it will become obvious to you that, you know, there's clear and convincing evidence for these 10 things that we laid out in the book. So with regards to how it meets the standard for, you know, how Oswald being impersonated would be a chokehold and was proven by clear and convincing evidence, what you're looking at is, and we're going to get into these, but you're looking at the quality of the incidences. So, you know, when we say impersonated, some people might think, oh, somebody said they saw a guy who looked like Oswald. That's what a lot of people think. It's like, yeah, anybody could after the fact say, you know, I think I saw him at this place. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about someone using the name Lee Oswald or Lee Harvey Oswald and then doing things that would be consistent with what, you know, the official narrative of Oswald is, you know, doing things that would be consistent with that. So when it comes to the evidentiary standard, we look at the quality of these episodes and then we look at, you know, how many were there? It's just like every time, you know, there's a new, you know, formerly beloved celebrity who we all find out was doing horrible things. You hear the first one and you go, man, I hope that's not true. And you hear the second one and you go, it's not looking good. And then you hear the 32nd one and you go, I knew that guy was terrible the whole time. I knew it, right? So it's the same thing. It's just a numbers game. All right. So yeah. And I'll also add there are, if we ever get around to doing a second edition, which we may one day, I've come across three additional ones I want to hit today that are, really all of these are care of, Harvey and Lee. And man, there are three more that I think are really contribute to it being a chokehold we'll have to cover today.
Okay. Well, let us begin unpacking the Oswald impersonators as presented in chokeholds. Why don't we start with Roger Craig and a number of other witnesses seeing, quote, Oswald, unquote, running down a grassy knoll in back of the Texas School Book Depository and Paul, the Latin passenger or driver of the car, also dovetails with something that you've spoken about in the past. But Matt, tell us about the, quote, Oswald, unquote, running down the back of the Texas School Book Depository. Why also that does not jibe with the Warren Commission's thesis?
No, it doesn't. And again, on the numbers game, it's, you know, there's five people who say that. Now, to be clear, of the five who say they saw someone running down the hill and then getting into a Nash Rambler, only three of them say that the person looked like Oswald, but the other two say that they didn't see them. So they don't say that he didn't, but I just want to clarify that. Yeah, you know, this guy named Marvin Robinson's driving through Dealey Plaza, and he remembered that this happened because he has to slam on the brakes to avoid hitting the Nash Rambler that's in front of him. And, Robinson's boss was this guy, Roy Cooper, and he was actually, let's see, where was Roy? He was in the car behind Robinson. So you got those two people. Then you got Helen Forrest and James Pennington, and they both did get a good look at the man, and they both said that he looked like Oswald, and they reported the same thing, running down the hill, getting in the Nash Rambler, coming out of the back of the building. And then Sheriff Roger Craig is the fifth witness to corroborate that. And, he, you know, he kind of lays out a similar story, seeing this guy come down, get in the vehicle. And then Craig famously went to the police department and, went to go, see Captain Fritz. And, you know, basically, he lets him know that what he saw, and Fritz thinking, hey, that's that kind of sounds like Oswald, the guy that we already have, says, you know, come on down, see if you can identify him. We got the guy in custody. Well, it turns out, he gets there and, according to Craig says that, you know, Oswald, you know, tells him, hey, that's Mrs. Payne's vehicle. Don't bring her into this. Now that's disputed by Fritz and, forget another guy who's there. But you know, they say that Craig may have come in the room, but they pretty much write him out of the whole story. But, I guess the credibility of Roger Craig is a separate thing. But yeah, that's the general story of the folks seeing the man coming out of the back of the building. I don't know if Paul or Jim want to add anything.
If I may, or Jim, you want to go first? I have a short point I wanted to bring here.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. So, you know, first of all, the word corroboration often comes back in this chapter. So what Matt was saying is these aren't lone people seeing what happened. It's corroborated by a number of people. The second point. In the corroboration, one thing that caught my eye in this particular impersonation is who Craig saw in the vehicle with Oswald. And it's a recurrent theme. He describes a short, stocky, Latino, someone with massive shoulders and massive arms. Well, that Latino, we found 20 other descriptions of Oswald being accompanied by someone who looked like that. And then there's another 20, we're up to over 45 descriptions of Oswald seen with Latinos. And now here, I'm not saying in each case he's being impersonated or not, but the fact that in many viewings of Oswald, he's accompanied by Latinos smacks of course, not alone not, but something Schweiker talked about. That Oswald could be seen sometimes with pro-Castro and other times with anti-Castro Cuban exiles. So that's something that keeps coming back. We see it with the Sylvia Audio incident, and we see it with the incident at the Sportsdrome because Oswald's again accompanied by Latinos. So that had to go away. The second thing that often, and Matt brings up, the excuse that the Warren Commission would be to fluff off these impersonations all the time would be, well, we know that the real Oswald wasn't there, so that can't be right. Okay, so in other words, you'll see in the Ralph Yates incident or others, well, no, we know he was working at the time, so that sighting can't be right. So they never acknowledged the possibility of impersonation.
Something, to the, obviously, if the lone nut was being impersonated, then he was not a lone nut. I wanted to pivot, unless any of the three of you had something additional to discuss about the Oswald running down the...
About the Roger Craig thing.
Yeah.
See, there's a couple of ways to look at this. You know, I find this incident credible, not just because Craig, but because, as Matt outlined, there's at least two other people, okay, and maybe as many as four other people, all right, who corroborate the incident happening. Now, if you accept it, as I do, all right, there's a couple ways to look at this, okay, at least two. If anybody else thinks of something else, please jibe in on it. Either the official story would have Oswald walking down to the bus station, getting on a bus, getting off the bus, and going to back towards the Texas School Book Depository, hailing a cab, giving the cab up to a little old lady. The little old lady says, no, fine, young man, you can go ahead and take it. All right. And then Oswald gets on the cab and goes towards his Beckley Street boarding house and gets out about four blocks away from it and then walks to the Beckley house. All right. Now, what are we confronted with? In this scenario, it would appear to be that there was an Oswald impersonator. The Oswald impersonator then went ahead and got in this Nash Rambler with what appears to be some kind of Hispanic, maybe a Cuban exile. All right. Okay. So if they are both true, then that's what happened. There was an Oswald impersonator right off the bat meant to confuse things, all right, in Dealey Plaza. Now, here's another way to look at it. If you've been involved in this case for a long time, as unfortunately I have been, all right, there's a lot of questions about the bus, Oswald being on that bus, and William Whaley, the taxi cab driver. All right. I'm not saying that they're both absolute mythologicals. Okay. But what I'm saying is that there's a lot of questions about those two. And I could sit here and pontificate about it for about 20 minutes, but I want to go on to the rest of the book. All right. And the rest of this chapter. If you sincerely take those criticisms to heart, okay, then Oswald got in that car. And that's how he got back to his rooming house. If that's true, then this completely annihilates the whole story about Oswald being some kind of a lone nut. All right. Now, I don't know which one is correct, but I think it's the job of serious people like us, you know, as opposed to the shills, all right, and the hacks, to explain the dichotomy and break it down and analyze it for what it appears to be. All right. So I'm really glad that Matt brought this up. And in the JFK assassination chokeholds, I believe this is one of the better essays. And we have Matt to thank. In fact, to be perfectly honest, and I've said this before, there isn't another one of these in this category that I don't, that compares with this. See, I think you'd have to go all the way back to the Richard Popkin book, the second Oswald, to find a point of comparison. And remember, that's a book. That's like 180 pages. All right. Well, Matt broke it down to about 20, all right, or 25. So I think this is a very good way to start with a review of the book.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Anything else that any of you gentlemen wanted to add about the, quote, Oswald, unquote, running down in the back of the Texas School Book Depository?
Just really super brief. Even if the three people who said that that was Oswald are mistaken and it was just some other random guy running down the hill, that's still mysterious. We would need to know what's going on. Why is he running out of the back of the depository, you know, after the shooting? So there you go.
Indeed. Something that I wanted to turn to next. And, you know, at this point in time, and with the official BS, still being bandied about, by the media, Trump, Biden, whoever, obviously, to anyone who can think, Oswald did not commit the crime, but I think the real significance at this point in time is what we can learn about the society in which we live. And perhaps this is my own perspective. If any gentleman want to correct that, that's fine. But the Ralph Yates incident, I think, is significant, not just for the particulars, and we'll talk about that, but what happened to Ralph Yates when he stuck to his story, I think really informs us about what kind of a society we are living in, because people, I think that there's a bottom line, and, you know, if something really went wrong, you know, everything, blah, 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 blah. Well, something went really, really wrong on 11/22/63. And when one looks at what happened to Ralph Yates for telling the truth, I think that is chillingly informative of what our society is about. So with that characteristically verbose introduction, Matt, tell us about Ralph Yates.
Yeah, Ralph Yates, the story of Ralph Yates, I first learned about in James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable. And it was one, you know, I thought that there was, since I've been studying this seriously, I thought there was, you know, more than one shooter. I just didn't really know the details. But this is a thing that kind of made me want to do the podcast, because what was crazy, and we'll talk about it, we'll cover the whole thing, but this is almost a smoking gun to me in terms of impersonation. And the only counterpoint, he sometimes talked foolishness, according to the one witness who confirms the story, but he confirms the story. So we'll get to it. But, long story short, Ralph Yates. So, okay. On the Wednesday before the assassination, Ralph Yates, who is a refrigerator repairman for, commercial refrigeration, he's out on a call, and he's coming back from a call, and he is going past, he's on the highway going past the Beckley exit, and he picks up a hitchhiker, and this hitchhiker gets in the car. It gets in the cab of the truck. He's got a long, about 4 foot long, he says, package that the guy that gets in the vehicle says it's got curtain rods in it. So they're driving, they're going down the road. And then the guy in the vehicle asked him if he's ever heard of Jack Ruby, which I didn't bring up in the book because I was keeping it kind of succinct, but he actually brings up, have you ever heard of Jack Ruby? He's known by Jacob Rubenstein, like basically because, you know, hey, you're a commercial refrigerator guy. Maybe you've been to his club. You know, he's like, no, I don't know Jack Ruby. And then he asks, do you think it, you know, then, Yates brings up to the guy, to the hitchhiker that, hey, the president's coming in town. And then the hitchhiker goes, hey, do you think someone could shoot the president from a tall building high up? So, that was pretty weird. And then Yates, you know, and this is something that I didn't put, in the book either that I think is important to note. Yates says in his story that the man pulled out a picture that was basically the backyard photo. and he shows him the backyard photo, a picture of him with a rifle and a pistol. So, that's really something. I don't know when exactly the backyard photo became public knowledge. I know it was in Life magazine in February of 64. This, FBI report is December of 63. But anyways.
Let me interrupt briefly. This is the, backyard photo of Oz, of full Oswald, unquote, with the militant right. And with the Mamluka Carcano and the revolver with which he is alleged to have shot Officer Tippett.
Yes. So he says that
on the cover of Life magazine.
Right.
Okay, very good.
Yes. And so he says he showed him that. All right. And it's like, this does kind of seem, you know, if you're just reading this and nothing else and without the other parts we're about to lay out, you kind of get Judith Barry Baker vibes. You're like, really? Tell me what else, Forrest Gump? Who else did you see? You know what I mean? What else did he say? Right. But there's some confirming information for it that's kind of mind blowing. Anyway, So after talking about Jack Ruby and the backyard picture and can you shoot the president, you know, from a building tall up, you know, from a tall building out a window, Yates asked the guy, all right, hey, where am I taking you? You know, I'm going back to Irving. Where do I drop you off? And he says, you know, drop me off at Elm and Houston, which is the Texas School Book Depository right there. So he dropped him off and he saw him take his package out and go in the depository. Now here's the whole key. Here's the whole game. Like if Dempsey Jones didn't exist, then Ralph Yates would be like a marginal case. It'd be like, hey, also there's the Ralph Yates guy. Yeah, I know it sounds like a lot, but you know, it's pretty crazy. But we got Dempsey Jones and Dempsey Jones kind of dials it all in. And so basically I have Dempsey Jones FBI report pulled up. Okay. So. It turns out when Yates gets back from the call on that Wednesday, he tells Dempsey Jones, his coworker. And so, you know, he says he picks up a hitchhiker and drops him off at the school book depository. Even that alone, like, it's like, that's pretty weird that you did confirm he picked up a hitchhiker and dropped him off at the school book depository. But it's not just that. He also confirmed that Dempsey told him about this man saying that he wanted to shoot the president at the first time he talked to him. So he said that on the Wednesday. There's no, I mean, you have to explain how he could have told Dempsey Jones, this third, you know, third party he works with, this, unless Dempsey Jones is in on it. But actually at the very top of the FBI report for Dempsey Jones, where he confirms Yates' story, he says, Yates is a big talker who always talks a lot of foolishness. That's a quote. It's like, okay, but he did in fact, you're confirming that he confirmed it before. And then the boss, confirmed to the FBI that he was out on a call at that time. And that would be consistent with, you know, his work schedule. So, there's a debate as to whether or not he was supposed to be in Oak Cliff at the time. But anyway, so Yates, the FBI then brings him in for a bunch of, polygraphs. He gives a statement and he tells him this. They're like, well, it shows that you believe what you're saying, but that can't be true. So we're going to have to give you a couple more. And then after three of them, J. Edgar Hoover himself sends a teletype personally saying, give him another polygraph. Wild. And so then, they give him another polygraph and they go, look, you passed it again. And so unfortunately this means you're insane and we're going to have to commit you to an insane asylum. And you know that he ends up dying there when he's 39 years old. I think he was like 28, 27 at the time, something like that. But he's in and out of insane asylums and he ends up getting 40 shock treatments. He never changed his story. And again, Dempsey Jones corroborated it in advance. I don't see how you can get around the argument. Like Dempsey Jones saying he talks a lot of foolishness. Okay, maybe he does, but you're telling us that he told you this on Wednesday about picking up a hitchhiker who he then dropped off at the depository, who he said wanted to shoot the president, who he said, look, well, you know, he says only Yates can know if the guy actually looked like Oswald, but Yates says this was Oswald after the fact. So this is where we kind of get into like the Harvey and Lee of it all. Like, are there, you know, on the, we should talk about this at some point. there's a few different possibilities for impersonations, okay? There's one specific guy who's always the impersonator. That's the Harvey and Lee theory. And that would make sense, because if so, that guy's got to kind of look a lot like Oswald, okay? But then separately, there's the, well, it's just different people impersonating him in different places, different times, just different people using his name and saying things that they think would incriminate him, right? Or the third thing is, there's no actual physical person doing the impersonations. Maybe it's just documents that are created to confuse the record and create a fiction. But that's not, those are the things I want to talk about, that I've come across recently. We didn't really cover, we covered just imposters in this chapter. But anyway, yeah, so that's the Yates story. Pretty crazy one.
Just to maybe to tie up a couple of loose ends here. This was incredible. I mean, talk about Kafkaesque. I mean, you read that. I mean, because he passes a polygraph, he's deemed insane. So the reason this was all problematic, right, is that the FBI had their story about how the rifle got into the Texas School Book Depository. They were going on the Bull Fraser. Witnessing of Oswald, who he gave a lift to the morning of the assassination, bringing in, you know, brown bags and that they claimed to be, curtain rods. But here again, this is why, you know, the official reason why the story isn't bought into. And from the chapter. We know that Oswald was working his regular hours at the depository on Wednesday when Yates says he picked up the hitchhiker. So Yates's hitchhiker cannot be the real Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, thanks, and Paul. Look, that's the headline I left out. My bad.
No, but that's good. But I mean, that's, it comes back. That's what comes back every time, whether it's Sylvia Audio or anyone. Since he was there, you know, so where is even the possibility of Oswald being impersonated considered in the Warren Commission? So that I think is, I stress that, I got that point, but that was an impressive, I think, story, that can't leave anybody cold.
Well, see, if you remember the Warren Report, okay. They did take up a couple of these incidents. They didn't take up the Yates story. All right. But they did take up and this was their excuse. Their excuse was, but we know that Lee Harvey Oswald was somewhere else, or we know that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't drive, you know, and when Richard Popkin wrote his book, The Second Oswald, you know, this is one of the things that he really criticized the Warren Commission about, was their refusal to even countenance the possibility that these were deliberate impersonations. And his book essentially said they completely missed the point, you know, because they had such tunnel vision about Oswald being a lone nut and acting by himself. So they refuse to consider even the possibility that this could have been some kind of plotting in advance, a parallel plot to the actual assassination of President Kennedy. They just did not want to even entertain that for 5 seconds. And this is how bad the Warren Commission really was. And so finally we have somebody like Matt in a book like this. Okay, the JFK assassination chokeholds, which shows you that the Warren Commission was up a creek without a paddle on this issue. There were just too many of them, you know?
One of the things that struck me, too, when Matt added the supplemental information, you have Jack Ruby being discussed at the same point in time, supposedly the second loan about this whole thing. And then you've got that, this is going to be on the radio, so I have to watch what I'm saying, that photograph, unquote, of Oswald in the backyard with the shadows going every which way and with a copy of the note and the pistol and so forth. That also, Paul, you spoke about Operation Mockingbird in the beginning. That goes – to C.D. Jackson and Henry Luce and the fundamental and pretty much across the board media cover-up, which I think at this point in time is as important as anything, to understand how our media function. They are not in the business of telling us the truth. They are in the business of telling us lies, and it falls to gentlemen like the three of you to tell us the truth. Go ahead, Matt, or Jim, I think you were going to say something.
Look, I think Matt, he can confirm this, but I think Matt, in that essay, pretty sure, isn't it about 16 or 17 incidents? Okay.
There's 17, I counted.
17.
And didn't you say you found three more?
I found three more, yeah.
So we're up to 20. How on earth can you have 20 happenstances? All right. How can you deny 20 of them? You know? It's just, you know, if you ever put this in front of an objective jury, all right, and this, of course, is one of the points of the book, you know, if you put this in front of any kind of screened jury, you know, screened out for purposes of objectivity, I'm pretty sure that they would say, well, this would result in an acquittal of Oswald. You know, this just cannot happen 20 times without it being deliberate. And if it's deliberate, then, as I said earlier, it configures some kind of alternative plot in advance to go ahead and confuse matters. All right.
Can I ask a question on this? Which I've had. We didn't raise
you
it in the book.
You wrote the essay. What are you doing asking questions?
Well, the question is about your opinion, and I'd like all your opinions, really. Okay, so we have all these instances of these impersonations. And people say, well, you know, someone would have talked, something would have happened. It's like, yeah, all these things happened, and it's so obvious. It's like too obvious. My question is, what do you think the logic was? So someone in theory is out there coordinating these impersonations or whatever it is. Any thoughts on like because wouldn't they know that, hey, Oswald's already at the depository. We can't have two of them at the same time. Like it just seems foolish how they did it.
Let me go first on this, if you don't mind. First thing is, I think the perpetrators were not going the lone nut route. They were going, you know, they knew there'd be a crossfire, but the fact that they didn't mind the idea that Oswald's colleagues were anti-Kennedy or pro-Castro Cubans. So, ergo, all these sightings with Latinos, okay, were important. Now, if you listen to what the testimonies are, it's always something about Oswald being unhinged, anti-Kennedy, right? And, you know, that there's sort of and think of this too there. Why seeing with two Latinos at a shooting range? Well, they knew that one of the arguments against Oswald would have been his poor skills as a shot. So they had to say, well, he wasn't out of practice. He wasn't, you know, they had to say that this guy was preparing for something. So it couldn't have been, you know, you couldn't have just have a no nut appear and make these three perfect shots. But I think what happened is that everybody got caught off guard when LBJ nixed this and said, we're going the lone nut route. So now you have to put the genie back into the bottle. So I think the whole thing, if you look at Oswald in Washington, Oswald at the shooting range, Oswald with Sylvie Audio, right? It's always something saying, hey, look, we're going to prepare. This is what a shooter, you know, on a conspiracy to kill him would have done. You know, we'll put the traces out ahead of time, and they had to put him out ahead of time because the real Oswald wasn't going to be leaving that type of trace.
Also, I think another aspect, and I'm pretty sure that, you know, we all are aware of this. Another thing was that to show premeditation, in other words, I think it was, and Matt can correct me if I'm wrong, But wasn't it at the Mercury car dealer that Oswald said that he test drove a car? Well, the witnesses said that he test drove a car and he said he thought he was going to be coming into some money. Okay.
That's right.
Right. Okay. And so that's another aspect of these. Okay. But getting back to Matt's point, I think that one of the reasons that the Warren Commission decided that we had to get disposed of these was precisely what he said. There were just too many of them. they had gone into overdrive. You know, it was so obvious. All right. And then when you get to the Sylvia Odio one, I mean, that's incredible that they went that far.
They didn't think it through. They just didn't. I guess they never thought there'd be people like us sleuthing around, but well.
Well, I think that if it had gone the conspiracy route, you know, look, think of what was happening in Mexico City, right? Mexico City, you had David Attlee Phillips there, a CIA, covert operation specialist, right? And he's setting up a whole scenario that Oswald's taking bribes, that he's seen with Castro agents, that he met with the head of assassinations in the Russian embassy. What do you think they're doing there? They're trying to say, hey, Castro's behind this whole thing. We have our excuse to invade the island. That's what's going on there, in my opinion. I mean, that's right out of ZR Rifle and Northwoods. It's handled by the covert specialists who are specialize in regime change. So, you have to think of it in these terms, that if with the Zapruder film, the witnesses and the obviousness of shots coming from different directions, that probably other people would have been blamed. And who would they have been? Maybe Oswald's Latino friends. And who would have these Latino friends be? Oh, they would have been pro-Castro. That's speculation, but everything there in the scenario leading up to the assassination has an element, not everything, but a lot, that he is both unhinged, he's preparing to shoot, he's getting practice, and he's working with Castro agents. And there's so many elements of framing Oswald in that way. I mean, there were letters that he was receiving from Cuba, you know, from Cubans saying, hey, we know you're a good shot. And, you know, don't forget that plan that we talked about. And then you have the letter in your own chapter of Oswald to Russia, the Russian embassy at the end, which was a fake letter. But it was a letter acknowledging what? That he had met the assassination czar in the Russia, you know, except he was calling him Kotskov instead of Kostikov, you know, so it's just smacks of a scenario where you could blame, and that's CR Rifle, right? Is you remove the opponent and you blame an adversary.
One of the things we've referred to it, but and this is also portrayed in the movie JFK, the director's cut, but the sports room. Quote Oswald, unquote, impersonators shooting. And what people saw, why that could not have been Oswald, and the general layout of that particular landscape is something that I think we should detail for the audience. Matt, did you want to start since this is your essay?
Yeah, can you say one more time?
The sports room, the quote Oswald.
Sports room, yeah. Hey, are we, if I could just real quick, 20 seconds, just sure. to tie a bow onto Ralph Yates. There's also a sighting of Oswald at the Dobbs House restaurant. And this is the famous one where J.D. Tippett's, you know, there at the same time. They don't speak to each other, but they're there. The waitress says he saw Tippett give Oswald a look, whatever. Okay. So what's interesting about that is that it's right next to the Beckley exit on the highway where Yates picks up Oswald at 10:30 on Wednesday. he's seen at 10 a.m. on Wednesday at the Dobbs House restaurant, which is right next to where he's picked up by Yates at 10:30. That FBI report and the Ralph Yates FBI report go together. Same human. So that's, it took me a minute to draw all that together. But anyway, on the sports,
perhaps,
sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Going forward, this will probably be for in the second hour here, 1326, but some of the Oswalds appeared composed. Some of them were kind of, quote, haywire, unquote, as you'd know. Let's reserve that though for the second hour. Oswald, the sports film, practicing with the rifle, and why that could not have been Oswald, and
right.
the general landscape of that particular element.
Yeah, so there are three witnesses who say that they saw Oswald practicing shooting a rifle at the Sportstrome rifle range. And the Warren Report actually addresses this, and they say that, you know, it couldn't have been Oswald doing the shooting because, number one, he didn't have a car, and the person that was seen, you know, going there came and left in a car. And the other reason is that all of the days when he was supposedly at the Sportstrome, they're on three different occasions. They're all times when he was with, Ruth Payne and Marina in Irving. And one of the times is when he is in Mexico City, according to the Warren Report. So the timing doesn't perfectly line up, doesn't line up at all in terms of, you know, where the Oswald that's on the record was. You know, in terms of what he was doing, gets back to, okay, why is he being impersonated? And I think what Jim said is correct, that they're just trying to make him look guilty. Guilty statements, guilty actions. I mean, you know, if Oswald was going to kill the president, he would need to have a lot of practice, you know, to be that good. And he would need to be really good already. So, you know, one of the things that is, I guess let's just start with Sterling Wood and his dad, Homer Wood. Sterling is 13 years old. Him and his dad are there. It's November 16th, Saturday before the assassination. And Dr. Wood said his son said that, you know, the guy shooting next to him had an unusual rifle that shot a ball of fire. And Wood then joked with his son that, hey, is that the watch out for the 105 howitzer? And his son said, don't worry, it's only an Italian carbine. And most of that man's shots were inside the target. Hey, Italian carbine, that would match the Mannlicher Carcano. So then of course, you know, when all these witnesses see Oswald later on TV, they go, hey, that's the guy. And specifically with Dr. Wood and his son, Dr. Wood noticed it first and he didn't say anything to his son. His son came in and said, hey, that's the guy we saw. That's the guy we saw. So, you know, according to Dr. Wood, he's not the one that told his son that. But anyway, then separately, we have Malcolm Price and Garland Slack. And, you know, they say Oswald came in a car, and Price, the man who they said was Oswald, asked Price to help him sight a weapon. And when he gave it back to him, the guy fired three shots, and they're all in a tight pattern inside the bullseye. So whoever this was impersonating him was an incredible shot. And that would fit the, you know, desired narrative, I suppose. But that's really the whole thing. And I'll say one more thing, and I believe this fact is in one of Jim's books, but the FBI collected 23 pounds of shells from the Sportstrome range to see if they could find any Carcano ammo, and they didn't find a single shell. So who knows if there actually was, or if they got rid of it, or, you know, who knows? That's a lot to sort through. But yeah, it's one more instance of Oswald, you know, being accounted for and then being impersonated in a way that makes him look guilty, in a very specific way. It makes him look guilty of the crime that's about to happen.
Two points. Paul, you mentioned too, that once again, the quote Oswald, unquote, was in the presence of a Husky looking Latino. And also, the quote Oswald, unquote, transportation to the Sportsdrome rifle range and how that conflicts with the official story of Oswald.
Yeah, well, in this case, I know it was one or two Latinos. I don't think he was the short, stocky one. There were many sightings, like about 20 sightings with him with the short, stocky one, but over 40 sightings with him and Latinos in general. So I recall this particular Latino was, get this, the Latino at the shooting range was dressed in fatigues, sported a Castro-like beard, and was made to look actually like Castro-like. And he would do things like pound on the sideboard so that he would bother the shooter who was practicing right beside him to get noticed. Of course, what this did, in my view, is that you have to keep in mind that the Oswald shooting records, and evaluations when he was in the Marines weren't very good. What we didn't know, we only found out recently, is that the Russians, when he was in Russia, actually evaluated his shooting skills. And they said that they were poor. And that is in a 1982 document that made it from Russia to the United States, to the CIA during more of a detente period. So we know that the problem with Oswald is he's a lousy shot, okay? And he's got a crap rifle and whatever. So the need to make his Confederates disappear created the next problem. How the heck can we now show that this guy was good enough to pull off what he did on November 22nd alone? How can we do that? And that created a different type of problem. So now what you get are these sort of arguments. Well, he wasn't that bad and this and that. But I mean, even Marina said that she knew of no occasions where he actually took his rifle to go to a practice range. I think at one point she came up with a silly thing saying that he would go out to shoot at leaves, like where in the middle of the city. But I mean, so that whole idea of I don't know about you, but I used to do target practice. You don't just come back after 4 or 3 or 2 years and say, oh, you know what? I'm going to hit a bullseye. If you were at one point a good shot. So for him to have pulled that off with a rifle that there's not even a sign of him sighting it properly. And some people say it was even sighted for a left-hander. There's so many problems around that, and they're made worse by the obligation to make the Sportsdrome event disappear. And how do they make it disappear again? Well, he was seen in a car, and it's known that he couldn't drive, and he was somewhere else at the time. So once again, they don't take into account the impersonator possibility.
Matt, the transportation used by quote Oswald unquote to the Sportsdrome rifle range is also problematic, and perhaps we can use that as something of a pivot point. We've got 7 or 8 minutes left in the program. Maybe we'll roll this over into our next segment. But how did Oswald quote Oswald unquote get to the rifle range? Why is that problematic?
Yeah, well, he didn't have a car, and he didn't drive as far as we know. And, even if he did drive or have a car, he didn't have access to Payne's car. She says he was with him, and he was in Mexico City on the other day, so according to the Warren Report. So if he shows up in a car, it's a problem. If he shows up with somebody else, that's also a problem. And both of those things happened, on at least one occasion with the Latino gentleman that Paul mentioned. So, there's no evidence that he's on a bus with a rifle. Now, when we get into the world of the General Walker shooting, of course, that's Marina's story that Oswald put on a raincoat with his full rifle and he took it on the bus and then he buried it in a field and there's no dirt on the rifle, but that's okay.
Well, Oswald supposedly did not drive, at least according to most accounts. And yet, one of the many, quote, Oswald, unquote, sightings is something portrayed in the movie JFK, where he goes and he suddenly becomes a NASCAR driver and then opines that he may have to go to Russia to get a car. Develop that for us, if you would, Matt.
Oh, when he's at the car dealership?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so he goes to the Lincoln Mercury showroom. It's actually near Dealey Plaza. And he tells this guy, Albert Bogard, that he's interested in buying a red Mercury Comet. And he said he didn't currently have any money, but that he had some money coming in within 2 or 3 weeks, and he would pay cash for the car then. So this is on Saturday, November 9th, which is what, you know.
About 2 weeks.
About 2 weeks before. Yeah, about a week and a half before, right? Oh, and here's the headline. He said his name was Lee Oswald. All right? So this man then test drove the Comet on Stemmons Freeways going 85 miles an hour. And afterwards, when they're trying to convince him to sign up for credit, and Oswald says, maybe I'm going to have to go back to Russia to buy a car. Like, wow. Okay. After that, Bogart says that he gave the man a card and he wrote the name Lee Oswald down after the man refused to provide his phone or address. So he got his name, because he's trying to be able to follow up with him and sell the guy a car. And he actually wrote down Lee Oswald. And, his claim about seeing Oswald is supported by assistant sales manager Frank Pizzo and Eugene Wilson, who also interacted with this man. And there's another salesman named Orrin Brown, who recalled that he also wrote down the customer's name and that the name was Oswald. And Brown's wife says that he had a piece of paper that said Oswald on it before the assassination. So you have all these corroborations. And so of course the Warren Report did specifically address this claim, and, they said, well, it couldn't have been Oswald because he didn't drive. And, the descriptions, I suppose, the description didn't match of Oswald and this man, but obviously he's talking about Russia. He's talking about coming into some money. It's pretty clear that he's trying to impersonate him. And again, it's corroborated. That's how you know it's not just like someone spinning a story, because there's always the thing of like someone could come forward after the fact if they're like really crazy and they're smart too, and they studied all the information and they know like the little puzzle pieces on the chess, the pieces on the chessboard, and they could go, aha, I'm going to insert myself here where there's this gray area. But that's not what's happening here. This is corroborated by multiple people, and they wrote a thing down. And his wife saw it because it was probably in his pants.
Indeed, we have maybe 4 minutes or so left in the program. I just want to do very quickly an in memoriam to two longtime researchers on the assassination landscape who have passed away. One, of course, was Cyril Wett, who died at the ripe old age of 93, and also Dr. William F. Pepper, who did some landmark work on the assassination of Martin Luther King, also passed away. So just a tip of the hat to both of them for their wonderful work during their lives. And they will, at least in these corners, they will be remembered and revered as they should be.
Amen.
Why don't we ruminate in the last few minutes here about, we're almost out of time, about getting the book. And then bear in mind, neither myself nor the radio stations that carry the program get any money whatsoever from this. So go ahead, folks.
Yeah, hey, if I could just say really quick, probably this book is an excellent starting point if you want to know, what are the main, the main propositions of fact that are supported by evidence that you can really, really defend, okay? That doesn't put all the pieces together, but it puts enough on the board to show that it's not what the Warren Report says. And I think the chapter that makes the whole book worth it is chapter 10, which chronicles the obstructions of justice. I'm not aware of anything else like that. It's the longest chapter in the book, and it just covers all the ways that, you know, every time there's an investigation, they try to block it. So, Paul and Andrew, Eiler, another one of the attorneys, co-wrote that, and they did just truly excellent work on that one. So that's what I would add.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks. Yeah.
The name of the book is the JFK Assassinations Chokeholds. All right. And the subtitle is that inescapably prove there was a conspiracy. And you can get it online at several. Well, Matt probably knows the venues you can get it at. It's Amazon.
Everywhere.
Barnes & Noble. Right. Okay. I think almost every outlet. You know, you can get it. And there's also, if we have any, there's going to be a French version coming out in a couple of months. Okay. If there's any French speakers. Okay. Wait for that one. And there's going to be an Audible version also.
We have a website called jfkchokeholds.com. You can find out about the authors on it. And, you know, you'll see an awful lot of links to wonderful podcasts and shows like yours. They will, of course, be adding it. So, you know, and you can follow us on Facebook and you'll get all sorts of news. If you go to the website or you want to order it, you know, you go, Amazon is an easy way. There are others. And again, if you have read it or you will read it, take the time to put in a nice word. It will really help. I'm telling you, this is the
we are almost, Paul, we're almost okay. Out of time. So we'll unpack this in the second segment. This concludes For the Record program number 1325. In review with Matt Plumpton, Paul Blow, and Jim DiGenio about the Oswald impersonators and chokeholds. This is being recorded on May 24th of the year 2024. For Paul, Jim, and Matt, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.